Today's presentation is What Can You Do About Climate Change by Ankur Desai. It relates to our seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence, of which we are a part. Ankur Desai is a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at the UW-Madison. He studies how ecosystems respond to climate variability and how the climate responds to ecological patterns and processes. Take it away, Ankur.
All right. Thanks for inviting me to come talk and have a little discussion about climate and climate change. I know it's probably a topic that's on your mind and sometimes a topic you don't really want to hear about or talk about, given the things that sometimes it makes you feel. But I hope to maybe leave you with a little bit of a message of kind of hope and how we might be able to actually come together as a community to address how we solve and how we handle the ways that the world is changing as a result of our actions and how we might be able to undo the worst of those. So, yes, as mentioned, you can call me Ankur. I'm a professor here in Atmospheric Oceanic Sciences, which is that tall, ugly building on campus with all the satellite dishes on top. We have a beautiful view, though. This is actually a view of one of my research sites in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. This was taken a couple days ago. We have a camera on the tower out there where we're monitoring the trees as they grow and breathe and change through the seasons and watch the carbon and water exchange between them. So I always like looking at this. It's such a beautiful view and such a blessing of the bounty of the natural resources we have in this part of the country. So we'll start by just thinking about, you've certainly heard a lot of things about climate change. And of course, what can you do about this is where we're going to end. And I'm not going to tell you to go change your light bulb. We're going to try to think a little deeper about this. But certainly, it's been quite a summer, right? We had a record-setting heat wave in Seattle with temperatures breaking into the hundreds Fahrenheit. Maybe you saw things about the fires in Mediterranean islands that led to evacuations. Perhaps you heard about the extreme flooding events in Germany, as well as the ones from Hurricane Irma in New York and New Jersey that led to some catastrophic disasters. Maybe you remember last winter when places in the South and Gulf Coast states suffered from an extreme cold event that led to significant power outages and that particularly hurt poorer communities and communities of color in particular that were often left without resources and infrastructure repairs for many, many weeks. And closer to home, we've seen, of course, events of extreme precipitation and rain and flooding. So here's a picture from Duluth from a year ago of high water levels affecting bridges in the area. And sometimes when you see these images, certainly when I see these images, I mean, you kind of get this feeling of like dread and hopelessness and kind of just what's going on? And, you know, there's this sense of change and I don't want to leave you with that feeling. And so hopefully I'll kind of try to give you a little bit better perspective of how we understand. Because one of the questions you might want to ask is, wow, oh man, this is climate change, right? This is what's happening. And a lot of times people just want to ask, well, did climate change just cause these events? And if so, like, you know, is that it? You know, this is what the world we're going to live in. And the one point I want to make is that that's really not the right question, right? The real question we want to ask is, how much does a changing climate influence the likelihood or magnitude or probability that something's going to happen? And of course, more relevant to all of us here, can we do something to reduce that likelihood? It's not so much that we can live in a world that has no hurricanes, that has no floods, that has no social injustice that leads to disasters hurting some communities more than others. We have ways. That's a social and, you know, question about how we live and how we work together. But we can try to understand the physical science behind climate to be able to make and reduce some of those harms, which is a fundamental kind of moral and ethical precept that we should have as peoples. So some of the stuff I'll talk about today is really the work of many climate scientists around the world. And in particular, these are the climate scientists I like to work with. These are the students and postdocs and staff in our eco-meteorology lab that studies ecosystems and climate. They come from all over the world, from many parts of the US as well as other countries. In this image from India, from China, from Indonesia, in addition to Germany, in addition to Alaska and New York and Minnesota, not to mention Wisconsin. And so this is a pre-pandemic picture back in the day when it was easier to gather like this. But when people ask me, what are climate scientists? Who are climate scientists? What do they look like? This is what they look like. And they're really smart people. Sorry, my mouse is not working so fast. Oh, too fast. All right. So one of the very basics, I'm a professor, I got to teach a little. What is climate, right? So you often think about what I like, you know, it sounds like a fancy thing, a lot of math, but it's really nothing more than the average of weather, right? And so often there's a quote that's often incorrectly attributed to Mark Twain, but it actually goes to Andrew John Herbertson, a meteorologist in the 19th century. Climate is what you expect, weather is what you get. And climate changes both naturally over long time periods, thousands of years, and by humans over shorter time periods like centuries. Both of those things can happen at once. I like this quote from Marshall Shepard. Marshall's a good colleague of mine. He's a former president of the American Meteorological Society and a great speaker. And he likes, I like this quote of his: climate is your personality while weather is your mood, right? It kind of sets the stage for what happens around it. So we can actually look at that in data. I'm a data geek. That's kind of what draws me a lot to science. And this is from the State Climatology Office. The gray bars here are the high and low temperatures every day in Madison for the last 10 months of 2021. And you can certainly see, you might remember that real cold snap we had in February. You might remember that we kind of had an early and warm spring in April, and that summer was kind of, it was warm and there wasn't too much variation. It didn't really feel like there were super hot days or super cold days. And you can kind of see that in this graph. That's the weather patterns. And here we are today. This is from yesterday. But what's really interesting to me are not the gray bars, but the red and the blue. The red and the blue are the 30-year average of that high and low temperature. And there are some things in there. What you can see, of course, is a seasonal pattern. It's not too surprising. It's cold in winter and warm in summers. There's some fluctuations, and you can see where we're going. And when people say, when you look at a weather forecast or something or hear one, when people say it's below normal or above normal day, what they're really meaning is that the high and low is either above or below these red and blue lines. And these are calculated under 30-year averages of weather. That is climate, right? And the question we want to ask is, as this changes, or if this changes, what happens to the weather that's occurring underneath? Because the weather is basically occurring mostly within these bounds, kind of moving up and around those. And that's really what climate change is, right? And that's sometimes like a hard message to get into when we say, oh, climate is changing 1 degree. Well, the 1 degree is the change in the blue and the red moving up by one. And that's then pushing, or kind of you're loading the dice of all of these little weather patterns that come through. You still have cold winters. You still have some nice summers, but you've just made some things more likely and some things less likely. And we can look at things like the average of climate across time for places like all of southern Wisconsin. You take the same type of data and you just plot it out from say 1900 to present. And you might look at this and be like, well, that's interesting. But I don't see a lot of big changes in this. I see some really warm years like the 1930s, some really cold snaps like in the 1970s, but nothing kind of that really sticks out in terms of the average annual temperature over one part of the globe. Well, maybe we'll take it out and look at, say, all of North America. Let's do the same thing. Well, now that kind of starts to look a little interesting here. The blues are below average years and the reds are above average years. And you can see the 1930s were a little bit warmer than average. That's often related to the Dust Bowl that we were having in North America. And you can also see some real cool time periods in the 1960s and 70s. It turns out this is actually related to the rapidly rising rates of air pollution during that time. It was kind of keeping climate actually cooler, even though it was causing plenty of health effects and for other reasons. And then you see this really interesting thing happen after 1980 or so. I teach students who are now generally born around 2001, 2002. And I often like to tell them that they have actually never lived in a below average year of climate for North America. But you still might say, okay, well, what does this mean? Does that really mean climate's changing? Maybe these are just patterns. And we can kind of do the same analysis for every spot in the globe. And again, the same colors, blues for below, the average climate for 1950 to 1980 in reds for above. And you can kind of look at these. Hopefully the animation is not too choppy for you in remote Zoom world, but you can see there's some interesting patterns. It seems like every 2 to 5 years, it goes from warm to red to blue in the tropical Pacific. That's called a cycle we call El Nino. You see sometimes when it's warm in the eastern United States, it's cool in the western United States. That's a very common pattern in our country. You can see every once in a while, there's some real big cold outbreaks in Siberia. And there's kind of some stuff happening, maybe that there's a lot more variability over the land masses than there are over the oceans that kind of seem to just vary. Maybe it's a little harder to tell. But then something kind of happens from about the 70s onward, and it's fun just to watch for a second. You can still see some blues now and then, but they kind of start to go away, and the animation is purposely slowing down here for us. You can see that 2013-14, that was a really cold winter for the Midwest, but that was actually pretty unique to the Midwest, right, in Northeast United States. Then we get into recent years, and the blues kind of disappear, except for a couple of really interesting spots, like the North Atlantic Ocean. And that's really kind of the cycle of climate change, right? There's something happening, and that's when you really start to, any one spot in the world can have cold years or warm years because of weather dynamics. But when you start looking at the whole world, you know, things like the Dust Bowl disappeared. That was really only in North America. And you really see from about mid-1970s onward, which is when some of the first big assessments of a changing climate were really put out, the first big computer models that basically very accurately predicted this trend started to really get raised in concern. It was 1968 that President Johnson formed the first U.S. Climate Committee of scientists to kind of look at this, based on work done in the 1950s by scientists who were building on the theoretical work that was done in the 1890s, far before anybody had, including some early scientific pioneers like Eunice Foote, a woman who is also famous for being the first signer of the Seneca Falls Declaration of Women's Suffrage, and kind of did the early pioneering work on how CO2 changes the atmosphere. And it was until recently that we started to learn more about her, because much of her work was, she could not present her work at a conference because it had to be presented by a man, and various other stories and some of the articles that came afterwards that kind of gained greater prominence due to gender discrimination at that time. But it's a really important story of the way that the science has really been trying to understand this for a long period of time. And when you look at 2020 as an average year, you can see that virtually every spot in the world is above average when you add it up, with an exception of places like the North Atlantic, where you actually have a really interesting dynamic of melting ice off of Greenland, cooling the waters here and kind of sinking that water and changing the dynamics of ocean circulation. So I like this chart from the New York Times that kind of looks at, well, what does that mean for weather? It sounded the same way. So this is kind of the weather, average weather in every location in the US and kind of in a distribution or a histogram, we like to call it, or a bell curve, if you're familiar with those, or Gaussian curves. And you can see, you know, there are some days that are really hot and some days that are really cold from 1950 to 1980. And what that looks like today, this is actual weather station observations. Whoops, went too far. Is basically that, yeah, we still have really cold days now and then. Jesus happened less often. And we now have 3-to-1 ratio of record highs to record lows in the United States in the most recent period of analysis in this particular. And so that's kind of the way it looks. And this is not new science, as I mentioned. I love this newspaper article from 1912 in a New Zealand newspaper that was dug up by Andrew Revkin, a reporter at the New York Times. The furnaces of the world now burn 2 billion tons of coal a year. When this is burned, united with oxygen, and adds 7 billion tons of carbon dioxide to the air. This tends to make the atmosphere a more effective blanket and raise temperature. This is a remarkably scientifically accurate, very short newspaper article, with one exception, which was the last sentence is wrong. The effect may be considerable in a few centuries. And the idea here that the understanding of the acceleration of the economy of people, of the way we are going to use fossil fuels in the 20th century was completely unexpected to most people, and certainly, but at the same time, the understanding that that would change climate was very well understood at a very long time ago. This is not new science in many ways. And so here's just some pictures of some, there's Eunice Foote on the top there and John Tyndall, kind of other pioneering 19th century scientists who kind of did some of that work. I love this image from Bloomberg magazine, where now we use computer models to ask questions. Well, what could change climate, right? We test hypotheses. So here's the observed temperature trend we just saw. And we can ask, well, Earth's orbit, it does change a little bit. The strength of the sun, that does change a little bit. Volcanoes, they emit CO2, but they also emit aerosols that on average cool climate for a few years, the most recent big one in 91. And if you look at all of those, we call those the natural factors. And we ask, well, how much temperature do they explain? We can run a computer model where we hold everything else constant but those. And we say, well, they do a really good job, right? They don't, those two lines don't really add up. We can also ask about human factors like land use change, land clearing, pollution like aerosols and ozone, which I mentioned, partly cold climate, and the greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane. And together, those human factors, kind of both warm and cool climate, but the greenhouse gas effect really dominates from about the 1950s onward. And that seems to do a better job capturing that trend that we saw in the white line. But it's really when you put all these together, both the natural and the human factors, that you really start to see a story of how well. We can't explain everything. We're not good enough. And that's good. That's job security for me. But we have a really good, there is no better hypothesis that exists that explains why climate is changing. And this is why 99.9% of scientists who study climate have basically said, this is basically how climate changes. CO2 is Earth's thermostat. And that's true today as it was in the past. So we can also look at tree rings and cores and records from thousands of years past. And one of the things that's remarkable is just how stable climate, which is shown here in the bottom graph, during a period of very stable carbon dioxide concentrations. And this is the period when really human civilization and agriculture and societies came to be. Humans are adapted to, human society in particular is adapted to very stable climates. And even though we had a couple of periods that are well known, like the medieval warm period that led to dramatic exploration and colonization out from Europe into North America, as well as things like the Little Ice Age that led to significant crop damage and societal collapses that led to many of the great upheavals of dynasties and countries that occurred around that time in Europe and elsewhere. So if we look at this at Wisconsin a little bit closer, it's a little bit more subtler, but Wisconsin is getting warmer. But what's interesting when you're in the middle of the country, far away from the oceans, is that in many ways, what happens here is more about what's happening north of us. And what's happening north of us is that winter is warming faster as sea ice melts and things like that. And so in many ways, what's interesting and also very difficult thing to figure out in terms of how climate change is affecting us locally is that Wisconsin is as much getting less cold as it's getting warmer. And that comes with both good and bad things. And that's also a difficult message to talk about, right? Because it is lower heating costs. It is less snow plowing. But it comes with, you know, and with all sorts of other questions. So here's the ice record, a number of days of ice on Lake Mendota, one of the most longest monitored ice records in the world. And you can see very clearly this loss of about, you know, typically 100 to 110 days of ice to something more like 90 days of ice. That has implications for lake ecosystems and the frequency of algal blooms, and of course, our ability to recreate in ice fish and other things. That earlier spring that's basically occurring with a warmer winter is also well documented in things like migration and in vegetation. You know, Leopold Bradley, who it's all the Leopold's mother or grandmother, kept very accurate records at their shack in Baraboo of all of these things. And it's one of our best records of kind of how local plants are changing and local migrations, and the offset in the two is affecting things like pollination. Wisconsin, if you have a warmer climate, you also get a more active hydrological cycle. So it rains more and it evaporates more. And that's very true, especially in winter in Wisconsin. We're getting more snow and more rain. And in the summer, we're getting more extreme rain, but only in the southern half. In the northern half of the state, it's actually getting drier. And so this is also really complicated. And certainly, I think many of us here are very cognizant and aware of the summer increase in summer extreme rains, which lead to some of the worst flooding events we've seen recently in southern Wisconsin, both in urban areas as well as in rural areas like shown here in Southwest Wisconsin. Here's the average number of 3-inch or greater rains in Madison from the 1950s onward, and it just kind of really pops out when you look at that. And as somebody who's bailed my basement several times in the past decade, it definitely is quite evident. So the question is, where are we and where are we headed and what can we do about this, right? So here we are in, and this is a lovely animation that people have shared. Here's that climate now shown as colors and our global change. And we kind of have we're at a point where we have to make some decisions, right? Where we can either kind of continue to use fossil fuels at the same rate we're doing and potentially increase it because we have a world that's developing, a world that we are trying to reduce poverty and a world that is urbanizing and has higher demands for things like meat eating and others. And many of those are good, right? We want to reduce poverty. We want people to be healthier and live longer. We want everyone to have the same kind of quality of life that folks in the developed world can have. But right now, that requires basically increasing our use of fossil fuels. And to do that is going to lead to a climate that brings us back to a climate we haven't seen in tens of millions of years on Earth. Or we make some decisions about how we smartly grow the world, and we take seriously these commitments to reduce emissions and use alternatives and promote energy sources and promote emissions reductions. And we're still going to have some climate warming. That's kind of baked into the system. We have to accept that a little bit. And that's part of our kind of moving past this sense that there's nothing we can do about it. And say, we're going to have to help the world a little bit, but this is going to be a lot easier. And most of what we know from the science is when you get above like around 2 degrees warming, that's when you really start to see more negative effects than any potential positive benefits from a warmer climate, like greater agricultural productivity and higher latitudes. This is what's going on right now. So in the so-called Conference of Parties 26 conference just wrapped up, this is the part of the UN Framework on Climate Change Convention that US and 190 other countries are signatories to since 1990, the Earth Rio Summit. And that basically sets the protocols in place for countries to determine how much they're going to reduce their emissions. It's a very complex political process because we have to ask these questions. Who does most of the emissions, which is primarily developed, richer countries that have done this since the start of the Industrial Revolution, are not necessarily the ones that are going to face the worst impacts, which are primarily in the developing world, primarily in communities along, say, the coast and in small island nations, primarily the global south, and really trying to recognize that there has to be some sort of equity or justice that plays into any discussion of how we reduce climate change. We owe it to the world to say we benefited from the way fossil fuels changed the world in many ways and also suffered in other ways. And we want the rest of the world to thrive, and we have to commit to making it thrive without making it worse for everyone and causing trillions of dollars of damages on net. It is far cheaper to move on this pathway on the bottom than it is the one on the top. And of course, there's many pathways in between, as well as some ones below these that are a little bit far more, require far more intervention, but are possible. I'm happy to talk about those in discussion as well. When you look at Wisconsin, we know that going on one pathway versus the other has a really large impact on our future temperatures. Whether we have 5 degrees Fahrenheit warming of climate, which maybe doubles our frequency of say 90 degree days in Madison and cuts in half or sub-zero days in Madison, or something that maybe even triples or quadruples that, you know, the decisions we're making in the next few decades are going to have a large impact on the type of planning we have to do in communities to be able to address the changes that might occur. So for example, my study works on ecosystems quite a bit, and we work a lot in northern Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which has some of the most expansive forests in the United States. These forests are highly productive, and they are a major source of revenue in terms of timber production that supports many industries, including paper and pulp. And so one of the things that folks have looked at, and this is an actual document called a Climate Change Field Guide for Forests, is these changes where, yes, we are reliant heavily on winter season logging around here. Growing seasons increasing by 14 to 49 days. Well, those two are a very broad range. Even a wetter forest can lead to drier forests because it turns out that under higher CO2, plants become more efficient in how they use the, how they use water, and they're going to open their stomata more, and they're actually going to dry out the soil faster. It's a really kind of counterintuitive finding. Without frozen ground, it becomes harder to log. Invasive species tend to, on average, do better or grow faster under a warmer climate. And deer in particular are likely to benefit from this. And that has a lot of implications for forest structure and composition, as well as deer health, right? A very overpopulated deer population is one that's more likely to face disease, more likely to have other issues as well. And of course, this feeds into plenty of politics about hunting and wolves and all sorts of things, and which are far beyond the discussion of climate change. But these are the kinds of things that are occurring in the background. So what can we do about climate change? So broadly, the community looks at this from perspective of what we call adaptation and mitigation. So adaptation is things we can do to reduce the harms of the climate change that's going to happen. And mitigation are ways we can just reduce the pace of climate change by reducing emissions. And the reason we have to do that is here we are. I like this graph. It's a little tricky. But basically, on the x-axis is the total amount of emissions from 1870. So it's kind of like a carbon budget. Just the total amount that we've emitted from coal, oil, and gas relative to how much climate will change. And here we are today. We know that there's probably at least another couple thousand more tons of CO2 from oil buried underground. And if we look at all the coal in the world, there's certainly something closer to 7,000 to 8,000. And if you think of the natural gas reserves that have been recently discovered, that kind of puts us all the way at the far right. If we stabilize emissions now, we still warm climate a little bit, right? If we wait 30 years, we are going to push past that threshold of 2 degrees warming, even if we stabilize emissions. You might say, well, we can afford it better if we wait 30 years. But the problem is the climate kind of takes time to respond. And the cost of doing this is not linear, right? It becomes exponentially larger to wait 30 years because the types of effects that occur are far more expensive. Right. And negative emissions, which I'm happy to talk about in the discussion, which involves taking CO2 out of the air by enhancing carbon sinks, enhancing ocean sinks, directly removing it and bury it underground. These are all technologies that are being looked at right now, are kind of our best hope. But a lot of those require significant research and development, as well as understanding the side effects and the negative effects of doing some of these. And so that's why adaptation, which includes both economic, political things, like do we account people whose island nations are being flooded by sea level rise for refugee status under UN guidelines for refugees. Right now, that's an open question, right? And we probably should, right? Because it's nothing that's under their control. It's the same as leaving your country because of war, right? As well as technological status. So rich countries in particular can build higher seawalls, can do other things. And that's certainly what you see in the United States. So this is the Outer Banks of North Carolina, where we're seeing some very dramatic effects occurring, right? Where folks are essentially just building their homes higher because the tides that come in, the floods that come in when the tide is high or hurricanes are coming in are just that much higher because of a slightly higher sea level that's already affecting those communities today. The mitigation challenge story is also complicated. It's very easy to be like, well, let's just reduce emissions. And that sounds really lovely. But when you think about the types of things that are required, whether that's making it more expensive to pollute, whether it's requiring and causing fines and other regulatory actions or agreements, whether that's through education and policies that change how we use fossil fuels. You know, so for example, just improving gender equality around the world improves household size and improves education levels and changes the way that people use fossil fuels, for example, and as a result, or technological changes like that we talked about. So here we are. This is the fossil fuel emissions from 1990 onward from this lovely global carbon project. You can see here's the COVID bump, right? So we did have the lockdowns that cut our emissions by 5 to 7%. And then we're kind of back a little bit to where we are. And you can see there was an acceleration in the 2000s. And then it kind of, there was the 2007 financial crisis. It's really cool. You can actually see economic recessions in the atmosphere through measurements of CO2. And then you have this kind of a little bit slowdown in growth. You're like, well, what's going on? That's really, are we actually like, maybe we're actually doing something? The thing is, you have to look at it by country. So if I take that same graph and I split it up by China, the US, the European Union, You can see the European Union has been kind of slowly declining. Some of that is in response to them signing the Kyoto Agreement and agreeing to reduce their emissions and building more efficient cities and transit. But part of it has been by outsourcing their manufacturing. And that's really what you see in this curve here. China's exports increased dramatically after 2000, as well as a country of a billion people that is rapidly urbanizing and developing and relying on the fact that they have 200 years of coal buried underground. But then that slowed down, right? And so the story of what's happening around the world is as much about a story that's happening in certain parts of the world versus the other. Meanwhile, in the US, our emissions have kind of stabilized. Part of that is a large-scale shift from coal to natural gas that occurred around the 2000s with the advent of hydraulic fracturing and discovery of large gas fields. That comes at a cost, for sure, to the environment. But natural gas does emit about half as much CO2 per energy generated as coal. And you can see here countries like India that are slowly creeping up as their population grows and urbanizes and develops. But you might say, okay, well, then this is really just a story. China's just got to reduce their emissions. That's it. But if you start looking at it per person, this is where it really becomes about what can you do. The story becomes necessary. The United States uses, the average person in the US uses about 3 to 4 to 15 times more energy and emissions than the average person in any other part of the world. And that's really interesting. Even China here is kind of closer to Europe, right? There are ways that the United States has to be the leader in emissions reduction. So even though they've made great strides, they have more ways to go. But there is a lot happening. There is kind of a lot of excitement occurring with Dane County in Wisconsin, retirement of 2 gigawatts of fossil fuels that are basically shutting down 2 major coal plants. All of South Australia's power comes from solar. There's 16 mini nuclears. You can debate the pros and cons of nuclear energy, but it is a potential. And for many people have argued you have to include nuclear in the energy mix if you actually want to get away from fossil fuels. And we have things going on between the US and China and discussions about emissions reductions that are happening. And so there are green leaves out there. And a lot of what you can do about climate is about thinking about where you stand on these types of questions and how you support and promote or these types, because these all come with costs for sure. These all come with environmental questions that you have to consider, things like transmission lines and the effect on landscapes, as well as global agreements and how that influences geopolitics and taxes. My own work has also shown that there's a lot of really interesting things we can do just by small changes in how we manage forests. We can actually increase our sequestration of carbon in trees while still managing them for timber and production for something like 10% of our fossil fuel emissions. You might say, well, that's not a big deal. But every single one of these things makes a small dent, and it's really putting them all together that you really start to get a story of how we're going to fix climate change. And the thing is, you might say, oh, well, there's so many people who don't care about climate change. How am I ever going to like convince them? And the story is that's actually misinformation, or really disinformation in some cases, active disinformation. The majority of Americans are either concerned or at least somewhat curious and about what climate. Most people are behind the idea that climate change is a problem that needs to be addressed. The people who are outright dismissive saying it's not happening, it's less than 7%. And that number has been declining with time, no surprise. Your neighbors care about climate change. And the real problem is, you can ask in Wisconsin, 80% of Wisconsinites support renewable energy. Research. 3/4 support regulating CO2. 70% support coal plant limitations on and emissions and renewable energy mandates. The problem is on the bottom side. We tend to believe our neighbors and our friends around us don't have these same values, or that they're very politically divided on this. And that's really not the case. What is the case is that most of us don't talk to each other about global warming. And so my simple solution to what do you do about climate change is exactly what you're doing right now, which is talking to me and talking to others and talking amongst the people you trust about, hey, what's changing around you? What do you care about? How do we still take care of the things we care about? And think about that culture of care, right? I mean, and that is something I think is very much within the wheelhouse of faith communities in particular, right? And the faith communities have also been in many cases, leaders also in trying to deal with the COVID crisis and the pandemic in very similar type of thing, just as a decision that as much as I'd love to be with you in person today, we have to be a precautionary principle to meet remotely, right? The thing is, there are people who are talking a lot about climate change, and that's people who are currently students or younger. I'd say it's usually the number one or two issue of people who are currently in college. And certainly here's Greta Thunberg, a well-known climate activist. But there's quite a bit of discussion going on, and supporting what's going on and talking to how what's happening on the ground in the same way that these movements led to changes in things like removing lead from gasoline and fixing the hole in the ozone hole, sort of phasing out of CFCs and aerosols and fire extinguishers and else air conditioning, in the same way that air pollution is reduced by an actually conservative Republican proposal called cap and trade that allowed for free market solutions to reduce acid rain damage from power plants. These things all exist and have been done before, but they really require that discussion to be happening. And I think that even if you don't care about climate change, there's lots of things you might, and the fire that kind of comes with that, there may be other issues around the world that we all have a reason to want to try to reduce the harms of, whether that's terrorism or water scarcity or oppression or public health or food insecurity or wealth inequality. And the point I like to make about this is that reducing climate change harms makes all of these things, a lot of things that we have an obligation, both ethically and morally, to try and address, not just in economics and how much is this going to cost or whatever, easier to solve. And I think that's the message that I want to take with you, right? That it's just there, whatever you care about, there's a way that the world we live in and the common air that we breathe, as we've learned very closely with COVID, right, is all of ours to share and take care of. And as a faith community, right, that message, which is very common in many faiths and beliefs in terms of stewardship of the earth and things, thinking about the role that humans have on that and how much we're dependent on nature to thrive, is very, very common in every single faith tradition and every single book that's out there. And I think that that's something that, you know, is a discussion to have in many ways. So I know I've gone a few minutes over time, so I should probably go, but I love this mural that was on State Street last year after the racial justice protests, and love is greater than fear, right? It's very easy to be afraid and to be, there's a term now that young people use, doomerism, right? Of a thing, there's nothing we can do, right? And really there is something you can do, which is to not be afraid, but to lead with love. And that's a message that I want to share with everyone around here today. So with that, I just thank you. And thank you for spending some time listening to me. And I'm happy to stick around if there is some discussion.
Thank you very much, Ankur. That was fascinating. And we do have time for some discussion.
Right there, as I mentioned, there's a lot of student interest in this question and working with undergraduates. I'm very fortunate and privileged to work with very engaged and bright students at University of Wisconsin and Madison. And my experience has been that many of them are just very curious and they're also very concerned. And so right now I often teach an undergraduate class called Global Change. It's a non-science majors class that focuses on writing. And we focus on trying to understand how scientists and others communicate around global change issues. And I'd have to say, we just tackle things head on, right? The science is there, right? There's nothing controversial, at least from my perspective as a scientist, about the science. It's pretty solid, basic 19th century physics. The real questions are about the social, economic, political challenges that go around to addressing those, which do have multiple perspectives, that do have different political traditions and thoughts about how you handle environmental harm. And then we focus on trying to, you know, I try to be very open and honest about those things. For example, we did an assignment where they had to look at the infrastructure bill and the budget bill that's currently being talked about in the White House and in the Congress, and to focus on some of the climate provisions in those bills and to represent a organization, regardless of how they, you know, and to write letters to both Senators Johnson and Baldwin using different rhetorical styles for those based on their ways that they think about, and that there were ways they could write effective letters to both senators on different sides of the aisle in terms of our American political system about the same issue. And so I think people want to talk about it, and there is really not a lot of shying away from, say, the complicated politics that go with addressing climate change, for sure. And the students are 100% behind, you know, it is their top concern, I'd say, more often than not. And I often bring it up, no matter what they're doing. I don't care what your major is. There's going to be some way that what's happening around you in the world in terms of climate is going to influence your career, or at least the way you live in the next 50 to 70 years. I'll share that slide again just real quick. So what's being brought up here is the green curve is Russia, right? And you can see Russia had a very dramatic increase in fossil fuels. And part of that is that they have a lot of fossil fuel reserves. And then we had the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so you can see that really big drop in 1990. But they're still very heavily dependent on coal and natural gas, primarily, especially for heating. And it's a pretty cold country for most of their population lives. And so they haven't had as much ability to, say, reduce emissions in that same way that some other countries have had. That is a big challenge, even in the US, where states like Wisconsin, Minnesota, and all that are heavily dependent on coal and natural gas for heating, have much higher emissions on average per capita than a state like California. Now, some of that is California has, you know, more stringent regulations, but they also have a much more easier to manage climate in terms of heating and cooling. I think every act like that matters, even if it sometimes feels symbolic, because it makes a statement from your community that these are values you care about. And when there is something that is big and does have a big impact, like, what do you feel about having a very large wind farm or solar farm in your community, right? You can kind of weigh those priorities against some of the other things and challenges that come with that. Certainly, one of the big challenges with fossil fuel emissions compared to, say, some of the other environmental issues of the past is that fossil fuels are kind of in everything, right? And so whether that's embedded in the food system, in transportation, in heating and cooling, and electricity, and so it's really, really difficult to untangle or to say that any one action that you do would dramatically reduce emissions. And so I tend to shy away, as much as I often like to make my students do these carbon footprint calculations and see how some of the choices they make do have an impact. We certainly know that in terms of individual mindfulness about things like where your food is coming from, we know, for example, beef versus chicken versus vegetables has a very, like, an order of magnitude difference among each in terms of total emissions generated. I don't like to get into talking about food because that's also tied closely to culture and who you are and family and practice, but there is something to be said about being mindful about what you eat and its environmental impact as well. There's a lot to be said for just thinking about how do we make making communities more equitable, and also improves many things, like, because some of equity is things like if we improve public transit, that improves, you know, and access to communities that can't get to places, that improves climate too, right? If we can improve, we also know that, right, challenges and things like wealth inequality and others also, you know, addressing those do a better job of promoting a healthier environment too. And many of these things tie closely to this idea of environmental justice, right? That the harms are often in communities that have the least to do with some of these challenges, and kind of viewing it from that lens, right? And advocating for that perspective in how you vote and how you think about policies is certainly important. Any one individual action, right, there isn't one that I would advocate over the others. I certainly have, you know, I chose to try to not drive as much to things as I can, right? I chose, as a climate scientist, we fly a lot to conferences. We have moved away from doing some of that, relying more on virtual technologies. And I think, you know, in terms of just making those little dents, even though things like aviation is only 2% of global emissions, has some impact, right? And it's certainly about setting your values clear.
Thank you. we'll all be thinking about those small mm-hmm. things that we can do to contribute, I think, and we'll probably have more conversation about that.
And I think talking and coming together and how you vote, and I think a lot of the questions that you're brought up come in local communities, right? Because even things like how you build infrastructure to adapt to changing precipitation and flood zones and things like that are important conversations that have to occur with individuals in communities, right? Nothing at the global level is going to address that.
Thank you so much, Ankur.
You're welcome. I'm happy to follow up with anyone over email anytime down the road, so you know where to find me.
All right. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.